Dan, where's Dan?
I just irritated the world at large. Oh.
He's talking to James Carney.
She's assuming that we're going to start 2 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our Tuesday, June 13th, 2006, Harbor Board of Aldermen work session. This evening, as with most of our works, as with our normal work sessions, second Tuesday, we're not receiving general public comment. So we'll proceed to our first item, a report from Dr. Anita Brown Graham on the law and inclusionary zoning in North Carolina. Dr. Brown. Graham. Oh, please come up to the podium up here and tell us all about it.
Well, good evening, and thank you all for having me this evening. I want to make a slight correction. I'm not a PhD, not doctor, and I tell you that for a very important reason. It is because I'm a lawyer, and for many of the questions that you may ask me, the answer will be, I don't know, it depends, and you need to understand that's why.
That's a juris doctor. All right.
I've been asked to spend some time with you this evening talking a little bit about the legal environment in North Carolina for inclusionary zoning programs. And I thought what I would do is divide this talk into two primary pieces. I want to talk a little bit about sort of the statutory context and whether local governments have any statutory authority at all to enact inclusionary zoning. And then I thought what I might do is then look at particular aspects of an inclusionary zoning ordinance by going through the Town of Manteo's ordinance, which I have been told you have, and to talk a little bit about how the way you put together an ordinance might have some bearing on whether a court might find that the implementation of the ordinance itself is illegal. So let me start with the bigger question, because it really is for space, and that's the question about whether any inclusionary zoning ordinance would be found to be illegal on its face in North Carolina because a court might determine that a local government does not have statutory authority granted by the General Assembly. There are really two bases for thinking about how courts would go through an analysis of this issue. And the first one is easy. First is the court is going to say, is there anything in the statutes that expressly prohibits you from engaging in inclusionary zoning? And I think the answer is clearly in North Carolina, no. The one caveat to that would be the restrictions in our general statutes on rent control. And so it is possible that if you had an inclusionary zoning ordinance that acted in effect as a rent control ordinance, that a court might look to that particular statutory provision and determine that you had acted outside the law. But beyond that, the real question for you and for any local government is going to be whether the court is going to assume that in the absence of an express prohibition, that there's some implied authority in the statutes for a local government to engage in this kind of activity. And when you start looking at implied authority, it's important to think about inclusionary zoning as really three types of activities. First of all, we have voluntary inclusionary zoning, and lots of local governments in North Carolina do this. Some have received special enabling legislation. Others just go ahead and do it. I'm not sure that there's any question that a local government can't provide incentives to a private developer to voluntarily engage in inclusionary zoning. So typically here we're talking about a scenario in which a local government would say, in exchange for a density bonus, you will agree to engage in some affordable housing development. That's easy, not really an issue of implied authority. The second way that we see inclusionary zoning taking place in North Carolina and around the country is what we refer to in our study as conditional inclusionary zoning. And that's a scenario where the local government engages in negotiations with private developers, typically under the rubric of asking the private developer to demonstrate that the development is consistent with the local government's comprehensive plan, including an affordable housing component. And there, to the extent that the private developer is able to demonstrate that consistency, the local government is likely to approve the plan. Those tend to be very quietly negotiated scenarios. That's what we saw in Chapel Hill. And, of course, you know, Chapel Hill is now thinking about a different kind of inclusionary zoning program, but that's the way it operated for years. The third category, which is the category that is the most thorny as a matter of law, is mandatory inclusionary zoning. And that's where a local government is saying to a developer, if you engage in a development of a certain size, and the local government can set that threshold at zero, it may set it at 150, but whatever the threshold size is in terms of units that are going to be constructed, you will be required to provide a certain percentage of those units as affordable. And the local government, in its discretion, may set that affordability standard wherever it may. There's no doubt, based on the national research that we conducted in 2004, that mandatory inclusionary zoning programs are the most effective programs if what you're looking for is number of units built as a result of the ordinance. So it's part of why so many local governments in North Carolina are very interested in trying to pursue this as a strategy, because if what you want is to get a lot of units on the ground, our study demonstrated, and this was true in North Carolina and beyond, voluntary programs are not particularly effective. That what developers will say is a density bonus in and of itself is just not enough incentive for us to engage in affordable housing. This is particularly true in strong housing markets, and it makes perfect economic sense why they might choose to do otherwise. Conditional inclusionary zoning tends to be more effective, but almost by definition, it's small, it's incremental, it's not getting you sort of the big developments. So everybody wants to talk about mandatory inclusionary zoning, and of course, this is where you're most likely to face resistance, might be too strong a word, from home builders, but certainly questions about your legal authority to do that. And so that's where I want to focus this conversation about statutory context, if I can. What we argued in our study was that the law in North Carolina is just simply unclear. I think that there is some argument that can be made that the zoning statute in and of itself, given the broad construction that courts are required to engage in terms of implied authority, give local government some coverage on inclusionary zoning. We also argued that the subdivision regulation statute gives some coverage, and finally, we knew it was a harder argument to make, but we said we thought that the general police powers, to the extent that courts have said that they provide an independent basis for land use regulations, themselves give some independent basis. I won't go through a long, complicated construction of each of these statutes, but I will say this. It is increasingly clear that despite the fact that North Carolina courts are required to give this broad construction in determining where local government has implied powers, the courts are evidencing a real reluctance to do so. So I don't want to suggest that the sky has fallen since we wrote this report in 2004, and I don't want to suggest that there's still not some reason to believe that a credible argument could be made that local governments can indeed engage in mandatory inclusionary zoning. But what I will say is that I'm not particularly excited about what the recent Durham case on impact fees says about how courts are going to look at these issues. Now, to be very clear, there's nothing particular about that case that governs this issue of inclusionary zoning. But what it does indicate, to me at least, and I'd be interested to know if Mike agrees with this since he spends a lot of time reading these cases, but what it does indicate to me is that the court is going to engage in an analysis that looks like this. It wants to first look at the face of the statute and determine whether the statute itself is clear in the extent of the authority it grants to local governments. And I think an argument could be made, particularly given what the court said about the zoning statute in this case, that just looking at the zoning statute, there's nothing about it that indicates any ambiguity with respect to this issue of inclusionary zoning. And if that's where the court ends the analysis, then the court is going to say, we don't need to go to this issue of broad construction to determine implied powers. What the zoning statute gives you the right to do is look at the usage of buildings, look at the density of population, but it doesn't give you the right to do this kind of what one Virginia court referred to as socioeconomic zoning. And I think you have to be clear about that. A different panel looking at the same statute might look at it differently, might say to the extent that the zoning statute speaks about public health and safety and welfare of communities, to the extent that affordable housing is at the core of those issues, then we think that there is some question about whether the General Assembly intended for local governments to have this strategy as part of their implied powers. And at this point, it's anybody's guess where the court will go with that. So that's the honest, open response I can give to you in terms of whether there is any clarity about how a court might deal with this issue. All right, let me pause there and just take some questions on that big picture, and then I'll spend some time talking about Manio.
Just one, and thank you for that very concise presentation. Am I correct? You look really familiar. Did you do the work with the Triangle J Council of Governments inclusionary zoning? That's what I remember. I participated in that, and that, as I understand, that created a lot of source material for your work. Is that right?
That's absolutely
right.
Yeah.
So, as you're probably aware, this board has been pursuing this issue for, gosh, it's 12, 13 years now, with the ultimate idea being from the beginning to move to step three, which was a mandatory policy, and as you're probably aware, the issues that you've just raised have caused us to, over time, cobble together a construction which is something of a hybrid of A and B, if you will. And it didn't start with that. We started with A, and it didn't do anything. And so then we constructed a couple of additional components to sort of provide the push as well as the pull.
Sure.
Anyway, so that's where we're at now. Can you react, I mean, specifically, the issue that our attorney has discussed with us to give us pause has been the whole Dillon's Rule construct, which I believe that you're describing as one of the influences that a court will use or would use in deciding such a matter if it were to come to court. My question has two parts.
Mm-hmm.
One, I haven't read the Durham court case or yet. Did that issue come up in their discussion of, in the court's discussion or in the court's opinion regarding that case?
Yes. So North Carolina is no longer a Dillon's Rule state. And this statutory provision, which says that local governments are to be granted those powers that are implied, reasonably necessary to carry out the express powers, makes North Carolina non-Dillon's Rule. But what you will see when you read the Court of Appeals decisions, and this is not the first one that you will see this happening, is they'll readily concede this issue of broader interpretation, but then act like it's a Dillon's Rule state.
Which I think is kind of what you're saying, right, Mike? The second part of my question just also has to do with the legislative environment, mm-hmm. in which, as you're probably aware, many local governments, ourselves, Chapel Hill, and others, have over time consistently, almost as a matter of rote, forwarded potential enabling legislation which got absolutely nowhere. We had a frightening encounter about, I don't remember how many sessions it was ago, when a bill actually got heard. It got before the local government committee, which L.A. Kinnaird was chairing at the time. And anyway, my concern has to do with sort of, again, reading the environment over at Jones Street, that a concern is preemptive legislation being prompted by something that you put forward. And I don't know if you were familiar with that little incident, if you will, but the bill was heard before the local government committee, and some things happened very, very rapidly where somebody who had been prompted by the Home Builders Association, realtors, and so forth, had a hip pocket piece of preemptive legislation, tried to put it on the floor as a substitute motion, and there was about 90 seconds of lightning-fast parliamentary scrambling to actually get the meeting adjourned before the piece of legislation got on the floor. Ellie was able to do that. So that was, a frightening little brush with how a piece brought forward might have been handled better. Can you talk a little bit about how you perceive the environment over there and perhaps if there may be some alternative strategies to pursue clarifying legislation or whether you think strategically that's a bad idea given that experience?
Well, I won't give you lobbying advice, but I'll tell you what I see and hear in the General Assembly. As part of the work that we did with the Triangle Council of Governments, you know, there was this, as you well know, very unique moment where we were sitting down with all of the major stakeholders, the local governments, the home builders, the affordable housing advocates, and it seemed to us that we might be able to create something that everybody could live with. And I participated in a number of conversations with members of the General Assembly, many of which left me with a very serious case of cognitive dissonance. Half the members we talked to were saying, you don't need special enabling legislation because local governments already have this authority. Leave it alone. Let it be under the radar screen. To the extent that you sort of bring it above the radar screen, you may do more harm than you do good. And the other half were saying, absolutely not. We'd never support this. This is, you know, this is a tax on home builders, blah, 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 blah. It's interesting that you asked the question about what the environment is today because recently I had a subsequent conversation with a small group of very supportive legislators on affordable housing issues, and they all said with unanimity, no equivocation, it will not happen. So clearly the mood around this issue has changed some in the last 2 years, and I can't tell you exactly why that is, except to say that I think that there is a heavy lobbying presence such that it would be very difficult to get either statewide authority, which is sort of what would make the most sense, but even local authority.
Yeah, this was a local bill.
Absolutely.
What was really scary, though, is that even though it was a local bill, if it had been reported out of committee with a negative recommendation, that negative recommendation would have been reported as a sense of the legislature, a legislative action which spoke to the issue, even though it were not explicit.
That's exactly
and
right.
And from what I've been told, and I see you nodding your hair, that would have put us in a far more precarious legal position than we were already. Is that a reasonable analysis?
As a practical matter, yes. I mean, as a legal matter, no. But as a practical matter,
yeah.
It would be taken as a read on the mood. And, you know, the conversation that I had recently was a conversation that was precipitated by a local community which had sort of reached some agreement with its home builders, local home builders, such that they were saying, look, you know, we're all going to come in here and support this together. And even within that context, the statewide lobbying presence is such that it just would not happen. Because for the very reasons that you're concerned about what message gets sent through these local bills, there are people on the other side of the issue who are equally concerned. And so to the extent that one locality gets this authority, it starts scaring everybody else about what might happen statewide.
And just a final question, and I'm sorry I went on a little too long, but Manteo's ordinance is interesting. The one that I spent the most time studying, however, was Davidson's.
Right.
And even had some conversations with the planning director. It wasn't the planning director, it was a guy in the planning department who had overseen the project. And the way that they constructed it was as under the rubric of an adequate public facility.
Mm-hmm.
What's their experience? I haven't talked to them in a couple of years. What's their experience been like lately? Do you know?
And they are creating units, not huge units, numbers of units, but, you know, Davidson's not a high-volume market either. You know, they went through a lot of trouble to craft their ordinance in a way that meets that standard. I actually am not sure that legally it would make any difference whatsoever if it were challenged. And so, you know, if you think about it, we've got two ordinances in North Carolina. mandatory inclusionary zoning ordinances to date. We've got Davidson's, which has never been challenged, and quite frankly, their market is such that they probably won't get a challenge. And then we have Manteo's. And Manteo's is brand new, and they're already worried about a challenge. So it just goes to show you that the local context is everything, and to the extent that you're in a place where you're likely to face the challenge, you know, you have to be prepared to go to court. I had a conversation recently with the mayor of Manteo, and they are getting prepared for this challenge. So we might have a legal answer to our question sooner rather than later.
It's yes. Too bad Manteo doesn't have a state legislator who could get a local bill passed for them.
I am definitely not responding to that.
You were going to go on to the more specific.
Okay.
Please do.
Sure. All right, so do you all have a copy of the Manteo ordinance? All right, I'm just going to walk through it a little bit, talk about some of the choices they made. As I've said, in preparation for facing some challenge, Manteo is already thinking about how they're going to refine this. So what we're talking about today may well be obsolete in a month. And I don't know exactly what the proposed challenges are, and I don't know exactly what provisions they're looking to change, but I do know that they're already contemplating some fairly significant changes. Having said that, they start their inclusionary zoning ordinance with a fairly significant statement of purpose, and it's not coincidental that they have done that. One of the places where these ordinances have been challenged quite frequently nationally has been under federal and state constitutional laws, where people have argued essentially that these ordinances amount to a taking of private property without just compensation. And one of the arguments that people make in creating this takings claim is that the ordinance is not directly linked to some legitimate legislative purpose. And so what Manteo has tried to do here is be very careful in articulating why this is an important ordinance for Manteo and how the remedies provided in the ordinance speak directly to issues that are created by development. Okay. So as you're thinking about this, I would encourage you, and I tend to encourage people to even go one step further and to do studies that support the creation of the ordinance and to cite perhaps the studies in the preamble of the ordinance. But either way, it has been really smart of Manteo to go ahead and set forth the need and the nexus. All right. Then they move on and they talk about the covered development projects, and here you'll notice that they, like Davidson, have very broad applicability of their statute, of their ordinance. So in Davidson, there is no threshold. If you are engaged in construction of one unit, you come under the Davidson inclusionary zoning ordinance. If it's eight or more, you're required to do some on-site building. If it's less than eight, you've got to do a payment in lieu, but everybody is implicated by the statute. In Manteo, they do have a threshold. It's five or more residential dwellings, and you'll notice that they make it very clear that it applies to all construction. It's new construction. It's rehab. Anything that implicates this five-unit threshold falls under the rubric of the ordinance and is therefore required to comply with the inclusionary zoning housing. All right. I think it's important in trying to figure out what your threshold would be to be very clear about what your market is so that you can justify that threshold based on market conditions within your local context. And I think Manteo actually spent a lot of time thinking about this. I know Chapel Hill is spending an enormous amount of time thinking about it. And I'd really encourage you as you think through this and if you move forward to see to think carefully about what a reasonable threshold would be given your market context. As with just about any inclusionary zoning ordinance, they then move from talking about what the threshold is to determining sort of what requirements flow from meeting that threshold. And one of the issues that's really important here, and this is actually an issue that I spent a lot of time talking to the folks in Chapel Hill about, is if you want to stay clear of constitutional challenges, the important thing to do is to make sure that the ordinance gives some predictability. a developer needs to be able to read it and understand how it applies and what the requirements will be. And to the extent that those aren't clear, you are much more likely to face some challenge under the Constitution. Having said that, one of the things that is a little troubling, perhaps, about the Manteo Ordinance is you will notice that while they are absolutely clear, they're clear without any basis for exceptions. So all of their housing is to be built on site. There's no provision for payment of fees in lieu of construction, nor is there a provision for off-site building. One fairly recent case out of California suggests, at least to me, that to the extent that you don't allow a developer to demonstrate that your ordinance creates an infeasible situation for that developer because of some extenuating circumstances, you are much more likely to find yourself the subject of a takings claim and a court is less likely to be sympathetic to the ordinance. So one thing to think about is, you know, you want to be clear and you want to create some presumptions, but they ought to be rebuttable presumptions. There ought to be some way that a developer, if the circumstances warrant it, can find a way to opt out or to make the project work through some other means because on-site just won't do in this particular project. So, and I think that's one of the things that Manteo is now spending a little bit of time thinking about. All righty. 11-4, which is the application and inclusionary housing plan, is all process stuff, and I won't spend any time talking about that because obviously that needs to vary from place to place. Let me talk a little bit about density bonuses because where courts across the country have tackled this issue of a takings claim, one of the things that seems to be really persuasive to the court on behalf of a locality is that the developer is getting something in return for this burden. And so to the extent that a density bonus is what you're offering, even if it doesn't give you a full compensation, it's giving the developer something. You'll also notice later on that Manteo goes one step further, and under 11.7 in development cost offsets, waives all otherwise applicable application fees, building permit fees, plan review fees, inspection fees, and such other development fees and costs which may be imposed by the town. Courts really like that. So to the extent that you're streamlining a process for the developer, you're making it more cost efficient in some way, again, that's an offset to the claim that you're taking away some economic value of the land without giving compensation. Yes?
Just as a point of clarity, is that just for the affordable units, or are those a waiver of fees for the whole project?
It's the affordable units.
Okay.
It's the affordable units. I had to go back and read that carefully to make sure it's the affordable units. Okay. You'll then notice in 11.8 that Manteo has worked really hard, and I recall having some conversations with their staff about these issues, to ensure that their inclusionary zoning ordinance is consistent with the underlying theory behind the benefits of inclusionary zoning. And there's some ordinances that do this very well. There are other ordinances that sort of assume it. I would suggest that given the questions in the North Carolina legal environment, it's better to say these things, why it is. So they make it very clear that this housing is to be fully integrated within the market rate housing. And again, if part of your argument is going to be that that benefits the general welfare of your community, then you want to say it in your ordinance very clearly. They talk a little bit about phasing of construction. This is not rocket science, but to the extent that this is a development that's going to take a long time to come to fruition or come to completion, you want to make sure that the affordable units are being done in step phase. This issue of exterior appearance is obviously a really important one to people who are proponents of inclusionary zoning. The whole point of making this integrated within market rate housing is because you want it to be socially inclusive. Well, you don't want to do that and have it very clear. If somebody rides down the street, that's the affordable housing unit. That's the affordable housing unit. Oh, my goodness, I don't want to live within three houses of that unit. So to the extent that it's clear in your ordinance that you expect the exterior to be consistent with the rest of the houses in a development, that's an important thing to say. And then, of course, they go ahead and make some modifications for interior appearance and finishes, and I won't spend much time talking about that. In the same way that it's important to look at your housing market and figuring out what your threshold is going to be, it's also important to think a little bit carefully about your population when you think about what the threshold is going to be for affordability. And so in the Manteo ordinance, you'll see that they're looking at low income as 65% of area median and then moderate income as 80% of area median. It's interesting to contrast this with Davidson's statute, which requires, let me make sure I got this right, for the units to meet affordability for people who are 80% or less of area median, but 30% of the units have to be for people who are at 50% or less. I think it's really important when you do your baseline studies to justify your program to really think carefully about who the people are in your jurisdiction who are in need and to try to make sure that you've got a program that's tailored to meet the needs of that particular population. You don't want to pick some arbitrary numbers just because they sound good. You need to be able to demonstrate, again, a nexus between what you're doing and the need that you've got in your particular community. It's not coincidental that the Manteo ordinance has so much focus on workforce housing because in many ways that was the impetus for this ordinance, that they recognized that they were having a hard time housing the people who they needed to serve their industry, and this is what they were trying to do with this ordinance. But I will tell you that I've noticed across the country that more and more ordinances are talking about workforce. And, you know, this is sort of where it's hard to make a distinction between what is in your legal best interest or practical best interest or political best interest. But for whatever reasons, workforce housing just seems to have a more soothing reaction from people than affordable housing. I don't have any advice one way or the other about what you want to include in your ordinance, but I will just tell you that it's not coincidental, I don't think, that you're seeing more and more of these ordinances, even ones that have already been acted, now be modified to make clear that they're trying to meet the needs of teachers and firefighters and police officers, and it just seems to have more acceptance community-wide that way. So, the range of affordability periods is an important issue. I think Manteo has gone all the way to the end of the continuum, and they're looking at affordability in perpetuity. I would say the average across the country is probably something like 25 or 30 years. So, when we surveyed communities across the country, the affordability issue was the one that everybody articulated as the most difficult. And we spent some time trying to figure out which practices were more likely to ensure continued affordability than others. Almost everybody has something in the deed, but they'll all tell you that somehow closings take place and somebody's not paying attention and the house ends up getting sold to somebody who doesn't meet the affordability requirement. And then as a local government, what exactly are you going to do about it once the transaction has transpired? So a lot of thinking has gone in recently to this issue of how can you really be sure? And I will say that what I've heard as being the most effective ways to ensure affordability are all fairly labor-intensive. It means having someone, and it might be a not-for-profit organization, or it might be somebody who works for local government, whose job it really is to keep up with these units, to spend the time sort of auditing, for want of a better word, the units on some regular basis. It might be annually, it might be every 3 years, it might be every 5 years. both so that you can know whether these transactions are taking place without your knowledge, whether the people have left and are renting the house and they're renting it to people who are not affordable. But one of the things that we heard from many jurisdictions, which I thought was actually interesting, is that sometimes the residents themselves forget about the restrictions. And so just by virtue of reconnecting with them and reminding them, that you sometimes raise the likelihood that they will comply with those restrictions. And so that's one of the benefits, I think, of having these audits take place from time to time. And then, of course, Mania goes through all of its affordability controls, resale issues. I don't want to sort of go through all of that in detail because that will vary depending on the way you set up your program. And I do want to make sure that I pause to answer any questions that you might have about this statute or about how you might enact your own ordinance. Yes.
How have people dealt with the issue of wealth creation and building equity? I mean, I can see somebody saying, hey, just because I only make $40,000 a year, why shouldn't I get to make the same percent money off of my house? Yeah. And you could almost see the lawsuit coming from the other side 10 years down the road, that how come the rich people in my neighborhood, around here it can go up over 10% a year, why do I only get 3% equity and they get more? Has that been dealt with at all?
It certainly is an argument that comes up a lot around some of the inequities that might take place in an inclusionary housing program. I haven't seen a lawsuit brought by the beneficiaries of the program, and I think they'd have a hard time prevailing on that argument. Jurisdictions handle the equity issue differently. You'll notice in Manio's that it's restricted to an index which includes cost of living increases and includes any capital improvements mm-hmm. that a person may have made in the house. There's some jurisdictions that have some sort of percentage that they say, you know, whatever the equity is, you're entitled to 20% of the equity, and 80% of the equity will be used to maintain the affordability of the unit. I think the judicious response to that issue is it's important to think about, and you want to make sure that you create an opportunity for people who benefit from this or any kind of affordable housing program to then sort of better position themselves for something else. On the other hand, as a local government, it seems to me that you're primary interest in a program like this is to ensure that you are creating an adequate supply of affordable units. And so the beneficiary is the group of people who will take advantage of this rather than the individual family who happens to be the first to get into the unit. Yeah.
The other counter argument to that is that while equity may not appreciate at the market rate, that the target population that you're reaching is a population until you enact such a measure, has no opportunity for building any equity. And in this case, in other words, they are priced out of the for-purchase market and therefore subject to the indentured servitude that we call rent, in which they build no equity whatsoever. So through essentially what is a subsidy mechanism, be it a public subsidy or a private subsidy that is built in through regulatory measures, what you are doing is providing an opportunity that would otherwise not exist for a population to build equity and to generate a measure of wealth, perhaps not the same measure of wealth that they would have generated had they the opportunity to get into the for-purchase market. However, at those income levels, part of the determination that's made to determine that population is that population that is, through market conditions, being excluded from participating in any wealth-generating process.
In fact, I think you could take it further and say, well, you know, if you work for the state and your salary goes up 3%, but housing costs go up 10%, then in fact, by renting, you're losing it 7% per year.
Right.
But anyway,
I think I like that argument. I like that myself.
Yeah, I was just going to say first, thank you very much for making the presentation, and thank you, Dan, for bringing here to make the presentation. I think one of the things we need to think about as one of the board's projects and priorities is to say we need to do a study. And I think we can factually show in Carrboro, and I would argue even in southern Orange County, that in fact there's an affordability problem. We can look both at the town situation in terms of how many employees actually live in Carrboro. We could also look at the hospital's situation in terms of how many, you know, how many employees of the hospital actually live in Carrboro, Chapel Hill. We could look at the school system and say, okay, for the two schools and the third school, how many of the teachers in of those three schools, or even all the Southern Orange County schools, actually live in Southern Orange County. I think, you know, I think it's the really great thing that came out of this for me is that we have the data to do a study. And some of the work we don't have to do ourselves because the Orange County Economic Development Office continues to tell us the number of houses that are purchased at a particular price. And we have, I guess, that data of what, the last maybe even 7 to 8 years. And so you can see, you can also indicate just, you know, the data is there about what the resale values for other houses. I mean, I think that's kind of important. So I would hope that we just not accept this, but we sort of decide we're going to do a study, and then out of that study we can develop some kind of ordinance. The second thing I would say is we might need to really get in touch with those communities that are having the same problem that we are. At a certain point, we can't rely on the idea that it cannot happen, that we have to say it may take us a long time to get what we want. But we have to, I think, because it's an important enough issue in a number of jurisdictions in North Carolina, that we have to say we have to come together with like-minded people and see where we can go and how we can get there. Because if we never try and never attempt, some things take longer than others. And I think we should just, you know, start getting the hard data of how it affects us. Because if you have less people commuting, then there's less costs on the road. If you have, you know, it's just we need to really analyze it in a fashion that we always analyze things in terms of the environment and say this is really important to us and this will make North Carolina better if we have this. And so I would encourage us to at least think about doing a study, and you know, I'm always like timelines because that's just the way I am, so it's not just out there in the netherworld and then we get it back. So that would be my comment.
Well, before we get into a discussion among ourselves, I want to make everyone aware that Anita's been on the road for 2 weeks and came to see us before going home to see her young child, so maybe we can ask her what questions she has and let her go on the way. And, you know, thank you so much for taking the time to do this tonight. Do you have a contact in Manteo that you could pass on to us so we could get an update on their thinking?
I could definitely do that. Okay. Let me just send you an
you
email.
Can email it.
I just had one other question on the Manteo ordinance. As far as I can tell, you know, we've sort of been using this, as Alex described it, kind of hybrid approach to dealing with this in Carrboro. And we have at this point, or this is my understanding, basically applied this principle that we're asking folks very strongly to include 15% affordable housing in developments that are as small as, I believe, as small as basically like 5 dwellings. Mm-hmm. But we haven't asked for anything, you know, at a size smaller than that. Is there a, you know, in other words, is there a type of development that's so small that it falls below the radar of the Manteo ordinance? Do you know?
So Manteo's threshold is 5.
It is five. I missed that.
Their threshold is 5.
Their threshold is 5, as is effectively ours. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anita, I wanted to thank you. I thought you did an excellent job in clarifying this issue, because having been on the planning board, it's huge, and no matter which way you cut it, it's always, as you say, thorny. I find it interesting that Manio has the threshold of 5 when Manio is very restricted by space. They have no place to grow except the ocean, and they're not going there. So 5 units would have to be a pretty big subdivision, which they really don't have the space for. So I thought that that was interesting in how they wrote this up. And the other thing I thought was interesting, too, is where it said under the integration of affordable housing units, it said the requirement shall not require a developer to construct dwelling units on waterfront lots.
So those two observations actually are flip sides of the same coin.
Right.
Part of what Mario wanted to be sure was that, you know, these really beautiful quadplexes that are waterfront property wouldn't be implicated by this ordinance, and those are extremely popular there. So they were trying to balance the interest of protecting an important segment of their market and not sort of getting those people's ire up while still being able to provide affordable housing for the people who serve that segment of the market. And it's a compromise, which, you know, in all of these ordinances throughout, there are lots of compromises.
Anita, thank you so much
for taking the time to help us out. I had thought about giving you a constitutional lecture on the takings clause.
We can do that next time.
At 7:30 at night, you might not appreciate that very much. Thank you all very much for listening. And if there's anything at all I can do to support your efforts, please don't hesitate to call.
Thank you.
Have a nice reunion.
I think you raised some interesting thoughts about that, Joel. And I guess, I have two somewhat different thoughts. One is that our current approach, it seems to me that there's a lot of things that are working well about our current approach. And it is a relatively fairly low-risk strategy that we're using right now. It's not a strategy that's likely to wind us up in court fighting over these issues. We have the lawyer that I would want to represent us if we were in court, that's for sure. But so on the one hand, I'm sort of struck by that aspect of what we're doing now, and I think the other thing that's interesting to think about is just what Anita was just saying, which is Mandio is bracing for that lawsuit. And so I'm sort of tempted to react to this situation by sitting back and seeing what happens to Mandio, whether they really get sued, and B, what the result of such a lawsuit is. I think, that sometimes you know this from being an attorney too, that sometimes the very caption of the case determines the outcome, and somehow North Carolina Home Builders Association versus Town of Carrboro, it just has a different ring than North Carolina Home Builders Association versus Town of Mandio.
But I guess what I'm saying is, though, I think we do ourselves a disservice. This is sort of my new general philosophy, which I'll be repeating quite a bit in the future, that I don't think we do a sufficient amount of data gathering that supports our position. Everyone says it is the touchy-feely type of thing, quote-unquote socioeconomic zoning. And it's my opinion, if you don't have the data on the ground to prove it, when you're in a situation that we do get pushback, we don't have the data to support our position.
I think
we do ourselves a disservice by not getting the data. And that does not necessarily mean that overnight we will move to a mandatory inclusionary zoning. But I want you to think about it. It's easier to be prepared to have the data. It is the same reason, and I don't want to be use this as an example because it's, but people tend not to want the data so you can't regulate appropriately. And so there's this philosophy that runs through some political circles that if you don't have the data, then it makes it difficult for you to regulate or say that there is a problem or an issue. For example, if you don't have enough sufficient money to test the water, then there's no indication that because you continue to pollute or to discharge someplace, you don't have the data to support the fact you're going to have to discharge differently. You need to treat the water with X, Y, and Z, as opposed to saying, well, it smells bad. Well, it smells bad, you know that's the way it's been smelling, and you have no, quote, unquote, data. That's my concern. If you, you know, if we don't necessarily have to change anything, but we may want to have the data just in case we do. And I would say to, you know, for me it's really important. This community in Southern Orange County, and I won't exclude Carrboro, is increasingly becoming unaffordable to working people. Working people. People who work hard for a living, not people that are sitting on the side of the road not working. And I think the mistake those of us, if I want to say on the left, make is we don't provide the economic data that says, hold on a minute. There are costs to doing things. And I just feel real strongly about that. And I would just encourage us, if there's a position that we want to hold that may be different from the majority, that we need to provide the data to say it's not so. The perfect example of that is providing data in predatory lending and how devastating that is and how they target low-income and minority communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's why I think you need the data. Now be quiet.
Yeah, I want to agree with Joel. I think the data she's suggesting, even if we didn't pursue inclusionary zoning ultimately, I think would be helpful to us in figuring out where we want to go and what our needs are and justifying other types of programs. And secondly, I think, you know, if, you know, as Mark's suggesting, so, and Anita was suggesting, sometime in the not-too-distant future there was some resolution in Manteo and that made us think we could go ahead with inclusionary zoning, I would like to be in a position to kind of jump on that when that time comes. And what I'm wondering if might make sense as a next step would be to ask staff to look at, basically to review Anita's comments in terms of the kinds of data we would need and tell us what we would need and what it would take to get it in terms of, you know, so a lot of it, as you were saying, Joel, is already available through the EDC, the university studies, that stuff all the time, and would be pretty easy. So, but maybe we can get some initial feedback from staff and, you know, then decide, you know, where to go from there in terms of additional research.
Thanks. And I mean, my thinking over about this has evolved over time. People who know me back 12 years ago when I was first campaigning, I was huffing and puffing and went, you know, who gives a damn what the General Assembly says, and let's do what we have to do. And over that the length of time that is has passed, we've seen what the practical implications of taking an approach like that could be, which could be that we would be in a more difficult position than we are now. What you don't want is the legislature or a court telling you you can't do something that you're already kind of doing. And so there are, again, legislative and judicial risks that one runs in taking a radical approach. I think the approach that Mark and Dan have put forward is the right one. We don't need to be the guinea pigs here, and we don't need to be the ones to potentially throw out what is becoming a series of products that are putting product on the ground. I mean, that's what we're, you know, we're not trying to generate ink here. what we're trying to generate are housing units on the ground.
Yeah.
And less ink, more units, I think, is really what we want to try to do. I also agree with Mark and Joel, however, that
Dan and Joel,
that
whatever his name is,
that there is still a lot of room to generate more specific and more justifiable criteria, and that this is the right time to start that work. So that's a strategy that I would suggest and agree with I think everybody that we should pursue.
Okay, well, so unless there's an objection to it, let's refer that matter to the staff, and I don't think we even need to particularly vote on that, but ask the staff to bring us back some reaction to the matters that Joel was talking about earlier. And I would just add, if I could, I think we should try to think about ways in which we can use graduate students and professors at Carolina as a resource for helping us to do that.
And the only other thing that I would ask, that maybe after we have completed that, we ought to share that with our brethren to the east and to the north.
Yes, indeed.
The imperialist neighbor to the east.
Our sister in chief. All right.
With that, I have to scoot just with one note. I support staff's recommendation for item number 3.
Okay, great. Thank you, Alex. Okay, so with that, we turn to agenda item 2 and update to the Recreation and Parks Comprehensive Master Plan for the town of Carver.
Anita, do you have any introductory comments?
Okay. Then we've got John Wood with Hayden Stanziel, who has done the update of our Recreation and Parks Master Plan, and John's here to give the board an overview of the document that you have in your agenda packets. John?
Everybody be able to see if we set up some larger versions of the maps?
I guess you can put them up.
I wasn't sure if that was going to clip the top or not in the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
You know what I think? Okay.
Okay.
Official
switch right up. That's
my age. Yeah.
Well, you want to stand and flip the boards, just on the side. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mayor and Board. We've been waiting for this moment to come and present the final results. We've been assisting Nita and the town probably for about a year and a quarter, and then waited a couple months to get on the agenda here for this update to the 1994 Parks and Recreation Master Plan. And I will quickly go through just some of the highlights on the package that you have in front of you. I'll let you know a little bit about how we got to where we are and some of the recommendations that are included. We went through, and this first map here, which shows that we inventoried all of the recreation facilities and parks, not only in Carrboro, which is the yellow, but we also looked at the planning area, which is right here in this sort of light yellow, both to the north and south, and then your neighbor to the east in Chapel Hill. We looked at those areas as well as county facilities. In this day and age, particularly with recreation funding, like with a lot of other municipal budgets, that's another funding that gets cut year after year. And we tend to go into these looking for potential partnerships that might be useful, where one entity might offer something that the other entity doesn't need to provide, and they can switch that vice versa, better use of the dollar. We also looked at population demographics here in Carrboro and who was using the parks. We looked at all the current programs and offerings that Anita's staff currently has out there, and some of the programs from other municipalities that are offered that may not be provided here in Carrboro. We looked at some of the staffing and how that played over in terms of the offerings. And then in the next, we also looked at all the things that had been done so far since 1994 with the plan that was in place at the time to see how things were moving along. And quite a few things had occurred. Most everything in black on our board are the things that had happened over the past 12 years. This is even updated through 2006 so far, where you've got the county looking at the park up at this end. We have Greenway land that has been dedicated, Martin Luther King Park up in here that's been dedicated and master planned. A lot of the other parks have had equipment and other types of things. Wilson Park here has had equipment added, Anderson Park. So there were a lot of things that were in that plan from 1994 that have moved forward with it. We then had behind us, through the whole process, a master plan work group, as they were called, that we met with repeatedly several times. They provided a lot of review and input. Randy served on that committee, as well as Diana, who is your former mayor pro tem. And we met with them, like I said, several times during that course. We also had some opportunities for the public to get involved, because we do find a lot of information from the public. And we had held three separate workshops, a Saturday morning over at Century Center. We'd done a Wednesday night in this room. We even had a booth set up during Carborough Day to catch a different crowd. And within those workshops, people were asked what they liked about the park systems, what was offered that they loved to do, how many times a week did they go to parks, were there things that were not offered that they had done other places, where could things improve. With that, we also handed out a survey. We had about 108 of those that were returned. And those surveys, we found out about two-thirds of the people who came and filled out those surveys did live in Carborough. The others were from predominantly Chapel Hill, who came in, but were using Carborough facilities. In particular, Anderson and Wilson Parks were probably the two most popular places to recreate. And behind that, Carborough Elementary School Park and Century Center, which obviously has become very popular in the 2 years that it's been up and running. We found out that a lot of people use the Bowling Creek Greenway, and we assume they're talking about the pieces in Chapel Hill since there are no trail facilities yet in Carborough, but that came up ranked very high in the surveys. And then, as I mentioned, you learn a lot about the public. They also provide us with a lot of connectivity opportunities between their neighborhoods, parks, and schools, because they were looking for ways to not have to get in the car to get to some of these places. They wanted to be able to walk and bike to downtown, get to the different parks and different schools. The top five recreational activities, which tend to show up in a lot of the comprehensive plans we do, and it fits the national trend, walking, biking, swimming, hiking, and then running or jogging. Those are probably the simplest activities that people can do just to get out and get exercise every day. It's a good activity for families to be together. But that meets the national trend. And hence, a lot of what this plan update became was also a guide to a Greenway master plan to look at trails and connectivities throughout Carborough. We also saw that Century Center obviously continues to get used more and more. We even found some of our master plan group meetings getting bumped to smaller rooms and specific times because that was all that was available. So that's good for ANIA, that's good for the town, that facility has a lot of use. So into our action plan that sets the directive, we did not find that the previous plan in 1994 had a lot of things that weren't happening correctly. So one of our recommendations was to keep on doing what you're doing. It just hasn't come on as fast as maybe it was aggressive in 1994. And that's not surprising as, once again, funding and land becomes a little scarcer. But we went out and looked at the possibility that Carborough should continue to look for partnerships and joint use, particularly here with the Twin Creeks Park complex with Orange County, the Bowling Creek facilities, as they start to come down and come into Chapel Hill and actually start to do some trail development on the Carborough side, the Homestead Aquatic Center up here, as swimming became up to the front again, with that one already underway or at least in the planning stages, it makes sense to try to at least latch on that for the time being, particularly for year-round use, but then to also look somewhere here in the downtown area for about 2 acres that we could do some type of at least an outdoor pool to help pick up the additional people that want to go swimming in the hotter months. The Morgan Creek Trail, once again down in here, to go ahead and continue to build on that acquisition that's already been taking place, but start to put some facilities in there. And then down in this corner, the Southern Community Park for Chapel Hill that they just last year got some Park and Recreation Trust Fund money for and hope to be underway with that towards the end of the year. Those were 5 opportunities to help join on to things that are already happening in the area and not repeat them right away until such time as we can get them on board in Carborough. One of the other items was to continue to find other partnerships with soccer facilities, which is another high trend recreation use, not just here but everywhere in the United States, it appears to be, especially this week with all the things that are going on.
Not if we keep playing the way we're playing.
The other thing that we did in our public workshops, because at the time we started, the Adams Track was just coming under entitlement with the town, and we put some things out and asked for opinion on what should we do with the Adams Track. Our recommendation is to move forward to a more formal master plan, but what we heard from the people who came, they would love to see a place to mountain bike. There were ones who would want to continue to see it, nature trails and environmental education, picnicking. And then another idea that came up from a few people were setting it up as some type of a challenge course for a little bit of revenue into the town. If you're familiar with COPE courses and training and that type of thing, that's what they had in mind with, you know, zip lines and towers, and it would fit into an environment such as that. The one of the groups that we unfortunately did not hear a lot from, even though it was tried particularly through Anita's staff, and that was the Latino population, which is another one of the special populations that continues to grow here in North Carolina. So we have suggested that we need to find a way to reach out more, get that group involved, because you know, that's one of the areas that particularly with soccer in mind, they do like to find places to play, and we need to provide that in place in areas. The other group that is often left out are the young teens, that 8 to 13 range families. There are several in the surveys that are looking for things to do that are more family-oriented. Fantasy games, board games that the teenagers are into, movie nights, bowling opportunities, even going just as far as personal growth type classes, teaching kids how to manage finances, deal with the pressures of stress, which is an ever-increasing ideal right now. And then the big part of it, the big part of the master plan got into greenways. Not upside-down greenways, but that's the next one. And we set up the back end of this report to look at different types of greenway facilities. There are about 6 different trail types that we identify, everything from just a basic nature trail, which is your earthen path, up to more of a gravel-type path that might be a little wider, and then asphalt-paved greenway trails, which are typically around 10 foot wide but allow for multi-use, and then connecting those even with on-street sidewalk systems, bike lanes, and that. And those are the main types of trails that we show here in Carborough. And you can see them on your map, but basically everything in red, a lot of these red lines are existing already, and we've gone through to try to connect these where it makes sense. with, and the dash lines represent proposed bike lanes that are already on the Carborough maps. Most of the light green is the type 3 or the gravel type trail. The darker green gets into more of the paved trail situations. We tried to look at areas where slope dictated whether it made more sense to pave it or to leave it as a natural facility, and have set the basis for a trail system throughout Carborough that not only links Carborough but then also starts to tie it in with Chapel Hill and Orange County. With that, we also had trail design guidelines, which so we'll not only get into the different surfaces, but slopes, drainage, furnishings, what does that greenway trail look like at the end. Identified some potential, these orange areas here represent potential trailheads, which is where you might actually set up a specific place for somebody where they might come, park, get out the bike, get the kids, the stroller, more so than a neighborhood access point, which is really where just the neighborhood gets on. There's not a place to park a car. It's meant to be more of a less pronounced entrance to the system. The last part of our master plan then identified funding, alternative funding sources, different types of grants. Once again, funding being the key problem of getting many things off the ground. There are numerous types of grants and funding opportunities out there requiring different types of matches. The most popular, the Parks and Recreation Trust Fund grant. We noticed this year in particular, there seemed to be a few more projects that were being awarded funding either solely for acquisition or for greenway construction. A few rec centers in there. It used to be it was all park construction, so they're starting to branch out a little bit more. This master plan update certainly helps towards those types of grant because it's you do need to keep it up to date and prove that you need these facilities, these trails for this for the community. So what we used as the basis for our plan was the mission statement that was already in place that the Recreation and Parks has, which is to enrich the leisure needs and quality of life for citizens by providing accessible facilities, creative and diverse recreation opportunities, and a safe public park system. And you know, we feel that with this plan that was done in 1994 and supplemented with this update in 2006, that Carborough will be able to continue to move forward and meet the needs of their community and those who come into the community to use these facilities.
I have a couple questions, but
so
if do you...
No.
Well, looking at and you'll have to forgive me. Some members of this board have been here a lot longer than me. On, for example, on page 15, it says fully develop the Morgan Creek Neighborhood Park. And I think I also saw that on one of your maps with an arrow that pointed to the Carborough High School site. And I guess what is that? I mean, what?
That was a park site that was actually identified in the 1994 plan mm-hmm. for that neighborhood or that community area mm-hmm. that has not moved forward, but we still felt it was needed to help service that school and that park area. So we continue to show it on the plan.
Mm-hmm.
There has not been through the property.
Well, nothing
has taken place on that yet, other than
right.
You do have the Martin Luther King Park, which is also in that same area.
Right. Yeah. I asked that question because I wonder whether you know it would be better for and I just picked that as just one example of this, but in some ways it you know I think y'all have done this to some extent, but. It would be better if it were clearer in the way that we write this plan that the point of it all is not that the town of Carrboro has to go out and Carrboro taxpayers buy a piece of property and build a park on it, but rather that the recreational resources that the people of Carrboro need are being met or being provided. And when I say that, I guess what I mean, for example, is, you know, I think it would be wise to for us to look at, for example, this idea of a Morgan Creek neighborhood park, and possibly consider whether that idea can be recast as in terms of, you know, providing some recreational resources that are. Under our policy of sharing certain kinds of recreational resources with the school system. In other words, this, I could see how somebody might look at this plan and say, gosh, well, you said you were going to build a park down here and you haven't done it. And I don't think that's really would be an entirely accurate – do you see what I'm trying to get at? So I just kind of have this reaction to this document in a couple different places where I feel like we should really be saying, look, we're not saying that these things are all going to be built by the town of Carrboro, because if you look at our capital improvements program for the next five and more years than that, there's not, you know, you – can we go back to – a couple of slides back, but you have one map there that shows in red a couple of, that one right there, shows a couple of really significant recreational opportunities. But for example, to pick another one, also over on the right there in red, it says toward the bottom, it says Morgan Creek Community Center, Construct Center. Well, I'm not necessarily opposed to having that be a part of our very long-range plan, but it might be wise for us to say quite how long-range we view that project to be, because, again, realistically, that's not something that we're going to do in the next 5 years, and it's not, you know, barring some really dramatic changes in our financial circumstances as a town, that's just not really going to happen. And so I just want us to be right. Clear about that. I want the public to understand that when we say if we adopt something that says Morgan Creek Community Center down there that you know we're saying one day, you know, far out there after the time we've developed the MLK Park and we've done a whole bunch of other things that we may get to that.
So more of a phasing sheet. That might be
well, because I don't know exactly what is contemplated there, but I, you know, that type of thing is a lot more like $1 million than $100,000. But even if it were only $100,000, it would still be a long way off in the future for us. So I just think we need to be clearer about the point that we see this as a really collaborative effort with our other local governments and the university and even OWASA, and also about the fact that some of these things are truly very long-range goals, and the fact that, you know, if we haven't gotten anywhere on building in the last 12 years on building the Morgan Creek Community Center, for example, that's okay. It was never really – I don't know what the board necessarily thought back in 1994, but that certainly as we're adapting an update now, we're clearly stating we're not necessarily saying this is going to happen in the next 12 years either. Anyway, mm-hmm. And if y'all want to react to that particular point, go right ahead.
I want to thank you so much for this master plan, and I understand, Mr. Mayor, your concern, and I think it could be addressed by relabeling some of that stuff and maybe putting in a statement of the long-range planning and short-term as a recreational specialist, which is what I study. First of all, I want to thank Alderman Brown, who made the motion 3-4 years ago to to redo the master plan for recreation. And Randy, and especially special credit goes to Diana McDuffie, who have been advocated for this, and especially for soccer fields in Carlboro. Thank you for all the good work you guys did. I think it's what I get out of this is a great tool for us, especially for fundraising purposes. I mean, I appreciate having identified those potential sites. I mean, if we got the money, I think we would love to do it. And I understand your concern that you don't want to give the impression we got the money. But there will be some funding opportunities, and you know, the Land Fund Tomorrow might be one of those. And
right.
And there will be some joint ventures with county and WAS and other folks that we can further explore. But having this tool help us make the case to justify writing a proposal. So it is like Alderman Brown was saying, you need to have the data to make your case.
Sure.
And that's how I see it. And I know a lot of work went into this, and I appreciate it for all the work you had done and the staff of Anita and all the staff and the commission who put a lot of hours into making this a reality. Thank you.
And that's what this is meant to be, is a guide and a tool to help staff each year as they set budgets and look. Demographics will change. It will continue to change every year.
I just don't want it to also be a brickbat.
Yeah.
It is, I guess, part of my issue. But
well, what I was going to say was, if we could, as Alderman Herrera said, sort of have, you know, I love timelines. Got it. If you don't write it down, if you don't have goals, you can't determine where you.
That.
Yeah, I do. I'm not just saying that. I'm really meaning that, because if you don't write it down, it won't get done. And I think maybe what we need to do as a board is to prioritize. We have done some prioritizing in the capital improvement plan, and I think we need to sort of incorporate those decision-making processes that we've already done into this document. Because we have, you know, we have sort of a basic plan, and unless somebody wants to dramatically modify that, we'll have to do that next year, come budget time. But that's what I would say. Because then that sort of, you know, that sort of gives people the expectation, if you put them both together, this is what we can afford and this is what we can do. And this is what we have been discussing, and this is what we cannot do at this particular time because we just don't have the funds. The other thing is, which my litany is saying, is that if we want to have things, we got to figure out how to pay for them, whatever the priorities are. And as we think about how we raise revenue, we have to think we have these needs that we have to pay for. And once we prioritize those needs, we need to look at how we're going to pay for them. My third comment is that I think there's a growing need for what I consider some sort of programs activities for preteens, like those people that are from 12 to about 15 or 16. And, you know, not everyone will be participating in sports in high school, and yet there are some people that want to continue to play sports. So we need to provide these opportunities both for girls and boys, young people to participate. We all know that the more sports that young women participate, the less early pregnancies we have. And so we need to be thinking about those kinds of things and just say, you know, that is a priority and those are the kind of things we need to think about. The other thing is, which is a kind of a comment that someone made in the survey, is that it would be nice to have, for some individuals, day camps that go full day. For working parents who work outside the home, because if you stay in the house with a child, you are always working too, that you do need, I think there's a need for camps that go all day long. And, you know, that's just the way, you know, if America would do a better job about a lot of other things, maybe we wouldn't need as much sports camp that go all day long. So I would just put a plug into that for the Recreation Department. I think it was great. I think it's a great report. You know, I just make those suggestions as my comments. And I hope we will not just set this aside and put it away, but really, and I don't know, is it available once we do the final one? Will it be available on the website?
It's on the website.
Okay,
now.
Good. So I would, you know, just those would be my suggestions. But great job from staff, from the people that were on the committee, and from you, because it was really appreciate really good work that we can continue to use. Thank you.
Randy and then Jackie.
Okay. I've got several things. First, I want to thank Anita and the commission and John, you and your folks. It was a long process. That was one long process, and we really sweated getting those surveys back, and they were, and I really appreciate the flexibility folks had even to have the surveys available on Carrboro Day. I think they were important. I am really appreciative of the fact that you mentioned the continuing concern that folks in and around downtown have to have a pool. And I will continue to, you know, voice that concern because it is a concern of folks who are immediately downtown and do not have access to a neighborhood pool. And Homestead Road is just not, it's not viable. So, you know, somehow we need to keep that in our thinking. The soccer fields as well, I think, you know, as we develop the parcels of land available, are fewer and fewer. There's great spaces still available, but the money will take partnering. So that's something for us to continue to think about. I did want to look at the I'm not sure I'm going to defer to Anita on this. In this document, I didn't see specifically whether or not the document, the report that's being made to the county commissioners tonight on the compiled countywide greenway trails, whether that is cited in this document and whether or not that should be.
We had an earlier, we didn't have the one that's currently going. We had some
so
earlier versions.
That might be
of
something that we consider doing. And in addition to that, a while back when I was talking about a Greenways Open Space and Preserve Commission, Alderman Gist had made a wonderful suggestion about a summit, and there's a lot of very positive feedback from advisory boards and phone calls and emails I've had to pursue it. So that's something I'd like us to consider when we're considering this document, is whether or not that's something we want also to look at approving, because there's great interest, and this document definitely reflects the interest in the Greenway space. So I would like to see in the partnering part that you have here, one of the things included is connectivity to the regional system of trails, the Raleigh trails, the American Tobacco trails, because I think that should be a goal that we have. And I want to hear what you all think, if that's something we would seek to have as a goal for our greenways.
Jackie.
Thanks for bringing up the summit, Randy. I know you and I are going to meet sometime in the next month or so and figure out how we're going to make that look. Appreciate all of the work on this. It's beautiful work. One thing that I really appreciate about it is the attention to the southern part of the town, because so much of our growth and development over the past 10 years has been happening to the north and up. What's going on in the south in very, very established neighborhoods tends not to be seen as much. And yet those folks certainly have needs. They have recreational needs. They have parks needs that we need to be paying attention to. So I do like how it gives us a full scope of the town from bottom to top, rather than just concentrating on a few areas that have been the squeaky wheels lately. I think that's really good. I view this more as a, and I think we need to do some wordsmanship to make sure that it's clear. This is, if we were meeting all of the needs, this is what we would have. Not every need, but if we if money wasn't an object and we were going to have the perfect recreation and park system, this is what it would come close to looking like. So it mainly gives us a list to choose from as things happen and as monies become available. But I agree with Mark. There are some things that have been on other plans for many years that pop up in conversations, and people say, well, you never did this, you never did that. And I'm like, well, when did we say we did that? You know, on September 2nd, 1981, you know? Yeah, so I think we need to be really cognizant of how it's, I think it becomes a matter of wordsmanship more than anything else, but it's so easy to sit and say what hasn't happened when you're looking at something that involves a great deal of work, and I'm aware of that, and thank you for all the work that that you've all put into it.
This is my last comment on this issue. The only thing that I would request as a board that we look about maintaining our facilities. And, you know, the one example that I hate to give, but I'm going to give it every time until it gets improved, are the Wilson Park
bathrooms.
I mean, if you have small children and you have to go in those bathrooms, God help you. That's all I got to say. And I'm not talking about safety. I'm talking about just their ability, because they're old. You know, it's not about cleanliness, although there's sometimes where there's no toilet tissue, but that's just the way, you know, it's a public facility. And I might add the one in Chapel Hill where all the soccer fields are, they don't have toilet tissue either. So just to they hear that.
to an inventory.
Yeah, what can I say? You know. But, I mean, really, we need to sort of, in our budgeting process, to keep in mind, it's nice to talk about having new facilities, but we have to also maintain the ones that we have. And so I hate to use Wilson Park as an example, but, you know, I've been long enough on the board that I think that's one of the things that we should think about and sort of figure out how we can budget for maintenance of all of the needs and sort of have a plan, you know.
So will we be increasing the toilet tissue line item?
No.
You need composting toilets.
We're going to name the building after when we finally get around to it.
In Latin America, we have a very creative way to recycle this paper.
Yeah. I want Joel to know that when we met several times, we talked about the facility needs for middle school age and young high school age students, and that's one of the reasons that the biking and some of the other kinds of activities that are active for children that age were discussed, and they were discussed at length, creating the kind of spaces that would be of interest and appropriate for that age group.
I wanted to add one more thing on this, on your Greenway Trails map. Can we look at that for just a minute? You know, and I don't know how important these things are. You know, this isn't our... I assume we aren't saying this is our Greenway plan by adopting it or whatever, but I think it's a really great map that you've shown there. I think some of those trails clearly would be much higher priorities than others, but if thinking big is what it's about, that one other really significant trail opportunity would be from down in the vicinity of the Heritage Hills subdivision, which is pretty much the last subdivision, the southernmost subdivision on that map, coming north up toward Carrboro High School and somehow connecting in with the Morgan Creek Trail would be a really significant opportunity. We know that no time soon will there be sidewalks that will lead people along Smith Level Road, and in terms of connectivity, you know, a larger picture connectivity, long-term, a trail that leads off in the direction of Chatham County, I think, would be a really a great thing to think about.
Especially to meet up with the American Tobacco Trail that is in Chatham.
That would be certainly one of the possibilities, even longer term than that. But
I was just going to say, if you want to bike to Walmart, yeah.
The other thing is that, you know, I would point out that folks down at Heritage Hills will be going to school. The high school students will be most likely going to school at Carborough High School there, and it would provide for a reasonable means to get up into that vicinity. But I would see that as a conversation we need to have with the Orange County Commission about how to make that happen and how to get that added into, because I don't believe, based on my cursory review of their plan, that that they show a trail along those lines on their plans right now. So anyway, I think we need to add something to show that there.
And then, also, with the bikeways that you just mentioned, I'm wondering if within this plan we should also show support for continued bikeways from Estes to connect up with Chapel Hills bikeways. I don't know how many times we can say that, but that's a little piece that means an awful lot.
Well, the main point that what I think is even more striking than that is that if the Bowling Creek Greenway that is contemplated in Carborough is built, it would connect through to Phase 3 of the Chapel Hill Bowling Creek Greenway and provide a completely or essentially completely off-road but paved connection, really according to this plan, all the way from Eubanks Road to University Mall in Chapel Hill. And that's
the plan.
You know, from my point of view, that's what our highest priority should be among all of these, well, except that we're working on part of Morgan Creek right now. But and then the final thing, and this is more of a, this is sort of a detail, I guess, but from my point of view, I think it would be more logical to show the connection to Eubanks Road as going through the county's Twin Creeks Park rather than through the Fox Meadow subdivision, which is the way that it's shown on there right now, simply because A, from everything I understand, the county is actually going to do that anyway, or if they're not planning on doing it anyway, then at least if we make it a part of our plan, then we've got a basis for telling them that they have to. When we review their conditional use permit application.
You mean the bicycle connection?
Oh, I'm talking about this. There's a big green line there.
It's going through.
Because the way they
Fox
have.
Fox Meadow, it's Fox Meadow and part of it and Lake Hogan Farms through to what will be, I guess, the Jones property?
Well. I guess my point is the northernmost part of that, the part that actually touches Eubanks Road on that map, it's going up through an existing neighborhood there at Fox Meadow. And what I'm saying is you know, maybe one day we would do that, but it seems much more, there's a much more immediate opportunity to have it go through, you know, alongside of elementary school number 10 up there.
And that's already there.
That's there, though.
That's already on the county plan that we saw.
Well, we haven't voted on the conditional use permit, and they haven't built it, and they haven't figured out how they're going to afford to build it. But, yeah.
Okay.
But other than that, it's there. Yeah.
It's on the plan. Okay.
But I'm laying it out there that, to me, that's the more logical route for that. I don't want to get into too much detail on this, but that's that connection to Eubanks Road just needs to be shifted further to the west. That's basically the point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anyway. And, I was gonna say, and the intent of the Greenway portion of this was really to sort of form the basis for a more detailed Greenway master plan at some point in the future the town might undertake.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure that a closer look at that would probably result in a whole bunch of other little changes like that, but it's just one that really strikes me because we've been looking at all that. And if the board can bear with me for a minute, I have to share with you one other thing that's sort of related to this plan, which is that the school board and the county commission have been in discussions about the recreational facilities that would be associated with elementary school number 10 up there on Eubanks Road. And basically, when Rashkus Elementary was being planned and built at out at Meadowmont in Chapel Hill, the town of Chapel Hill and Orange County and the school board struck a deal under which the town of Chapel Hill paid the extra cost to have a community gymnasium built as a part of I'm not sure exactly how they divided up the cost, but basically the town of Chapel Hill paid for this gymnasium or paid for the incremental difference in cost that a community gymnasium would cost as opposed to a gym that would just serve elementary school students. And the school board chair and the county commission chair asked me whether we would be interested in doing the same, and the kind of money involved in that type of decision would be, you know, on the order of like $400,000 or $500,000. And my reaction to that was, you know, even if we had $400,000 or $500,000 to spend on additional recreation facilities that are not already in our CIP, I don't know that that would be where our highest priority would lay. And so that's where things stand now. But if the board feels differently than that, then now would be the time for us to speak, because they're doing the architectural work right now.
How much can we get for
Let's make a deal.
You know, I mean, you know, what can we do for $200,000? What can we do for... Because $500,000 is a considerable amount of money, and we have a considerable amount of what I call capital improvement pressures upon us. And, you know, the timing's kind of, I'm sorry, I thought I talked loud enough. At least my position is the timing's kind of bad for us financially, not that we are broke per se, but we just have so many things that are ahead of that. And I, you know, it may have to lay there where it lays. So, I mean, it would be great if we had an extra $500,000, but I, you know, just my opinion personally, I don't think we can afford it.
Are you talking about the school that will be at Monese Nump or Twin?
Right.
Okay.
It's the school.
Whatever they call it.
Would be up there.
So, but that, okay, but that's also county, right? So it's county.
Well, the county's going to pay for an elementary school gymnasium, but if
right.
you want it to be suitable to serve grown-ups as well and built with a different set of security features that
right.
would make it more accessible to the public and still keep the school secure,
mm-hmm.
then there's an extra cost to that, and
mm-hmm.
that extra cost is into that kind of money.
Are we considering a swimming pool?
Yeah,
well, I don't think we can afford a swimming pool because swimming pools cost.
They're interested in talking to us about funding a swimming pool, but it's the one they're already building.
Right.
Well,
which
you know,
is not exactly in our
so
neck of the woods.
We should just be quiet on that one.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just say we don't have the money. Let's just
right.
be quite clear.
Well, let's.
That we don't have the ducats.
Right.
No, unless we start having a bake sale right now and keep doing it for every week.
All right. Well, I that was my feeling and my gut reaction that I gave them, but I also told them that I would bring the matter up in connection
agree.
With this. Agree.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
We didn't introduce Bert Lynn, who's my Vanna for the night. Bert did all the mapping for us. All of this GIS information will be turned back over to the town for use in all their future mapping as well.
Okay.
So
okay.
We thank
nice
you.
Nice job. Right. Good maps.
Thank you.
All right.
Can we get the maps on the website potentially?
Yeah.
Once we finalize the, you know? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
There they are.
I can tell I haven't looked at the website.
Okay. Thank you all for that. Mr. Manager, insurance recommendation for events, if you could be brief.
Anita's got a very brief presentation to give you all an overview of what's in your packet. You'll come on up, Anita. And
we have with us tonight, I don't know if Anita's going to introduce him or not, but Bob Haynes, who's waited patiently back here with the North Carolina League of Municipalities Risk Management Program. And Bob's here as a resource with his lovely wife, and they have had a great time, I know, back there watching this meeting. So.
You've heard about the nightlife in Carrboro.
Now you've Tuesday lived night
it. They're trying to go out and spend some money in Carrboro if they can get
okay,
out.
Well, so
nothing will be open if we don't get out soon.
All right.
We'll work hard on that.
It's going to be another 12, 11, 10.
Good evening. This presentation will be brief, but what I want to do is provide an overview of what staff is recommending in terms of insurance recommendations. Just a little background. On April 25th, Alderman Dan Coleman asked staff to look at insurance recommendations and bring it back for a future board discussion, and here we are tonight to do that. During that meeting, and also other meetings, there were some concerns raised about why and when the town requests various organizations and businesses to provide insurance during events on town property. Having this insurance definitely would not only protect the town, but it would also protect those insured organizations and businesses. The town is currently insured under the North Carolina League of Municipalities. Our coverage does not protect entities currently not under the town's umbrella, so that's important to mention. Staff reviewed all of the events that we either participate in or we provide for the community. And we assessed each event based on levels of risk in terms of the current insurance standards. And on all of the events, they are identified as low or high risk. And all of our events are categorized in three particular categories, one being town events, which would be on and off of town property, which is important to note, town-sponsored events, and also reservations that we provide for other groups and organizations that want to use our facilities. Out of our assessment, we have three recommendations for your consideration. The events that fall under the low-risk category, we recommend that they do not provide insurance for additional insurance for events. This would include events that would fall under little or no physical activity of the participants and spectators, no severe exposure to our spectators, and also individuals that would not go over 500 in attendance. We also recommend for those particular events or portions of events that fall under the high-risk category, that they require a minimum of three items. One, a signed agreement to hold harmless, defend and indemnify the town of Carrboro, to carry commercial general liability insurance with a limit of $1 million endorsed to the name the town as an additional insured, and also provide us a certificate of that information so we could have it for documentation. This would include items such as attendance, events that have attendance over 500, those items where, or those events that we would have large quantities of monies that would be on town property of over $1,000. Those events where we would have food catered or we sell food, and also those events that would be at the Century Center where alcohol would be served or sold, but would not be served through a licensed caterer or distributor. And finally, if we have town events off of town property, and we do have many events and that fall under that area, that we expect that business and organization to have $1 million of general property insurance coverage. Now, as you can see before you is a basic grid to try to outline our low-risk and high-risk events. When we talk about low risk, we're talking about our recreation and park classes, our special events, fishing rodeos, political rallies, festivals, parades without floats, Halloween carnivals, and things of that nature. When we talk about events that have high risk, we're talking about events such as, and this is only a portion of this event, the 4th of July celebration is certainly under our current insurance structure. But when we work with vendors that have mechanically operated amusement devices, such as the bounce houses and things of that nature, those vendors would require additional insurance because they're very high risk. So only that particular portion of that event would be included. And as you can see, it's not very many items on that particular side. Parades with floats that are gas-powered, modes of transportation, cars, motorcycles, things of that nature, because that's high risk, and also road races. So that's pretty much the recommendations from staff, and I just wanted to share those with you. As Steve did say, Mr. Haynes is here with us to answer any questions, and wanted to see if you had any questions of me.
I have a quick
Joel, then Randy, and then Dan.
I just have a quick question of Mr. Haynes. Normally, what do you normally see the most claims for in terms for towns in sort of these type of events? I'm just curious.
Fortunately, we've not seen a lot of claims. But I think if you've got somebody coming in with mechanically operated amusement devices or there's alcohol being served, the prudent thing to do is to make sure they have their own insurance. Mm-hmm. But to say that we see a lot of claims in one particular area over another would be tough to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Randy.
Okay. So, Anita, let's get this clear. You know, I'm looking to get the Friends of Bowling Creek back on the Carbo side of festivals. But I see festivals are on both sides. One side has it as low risk. The other side has the Carbo Music Festival as high risk because it's got a mechanical something or other, some amusement. Friends of Bowling Creek do have live music. Where would it fall? Would it be low or high?
It depends. For the most part, from what I can recall of that request, it would be a low request event. Now, keep in mind, we're not looking at the actual event itself. We're looking at each portion of the event to determine whether it's high or low risk. If they were having a festival where they would have music, gatherings, maybe some very small selling of items, that part would be low risk. If we were to have a road race, that particular portion would be high risk.
Right.
So it really would determine. So in this particular scenario, we are not looking at canceling a complete event. We're looking at the portions of the event and how it falls into the standards, because that's really important. I mean, we have to do that when we take a look at our insurance
guidelines. And that will be documented in the application process?
Yes. I mean, we certainly would go through that. But let me just go back and use the example, if I may, of the Orange County Peace Coalition. They, under this particular event section, they would not require insurance. We wouldn't have had them to require insurance because it would be it would fall under either a festival or political rally.
But if they wanted impeachment and bouncy house, they would have to
the bouncy house. Yes, that particular vendor
would have to have. And we're currently, and just FYI, we're currently doing that now. Yeah. In our 4th of July celebration, we do have a bounce house, and they are currently providing insurance to us. So
is a bounce house a mean walk?
Yes, the bounce house, the ones with the balls, anything that's mechanically driven where there could be some failure.
Anything kids get inside.
Somebody could be hurt.
Yeah.
Dan.
Anita, thanks very much for this proposal. I think it's very responsive to the concerns that were raised. I have a couple additional clarifications. This 500 number, is that like through the course of an event, or does that mean at one time? Because what I'm thinking is like for the Friends of Bowling Creek, or you know something that might go say from 1 to 6 in the afternoon, and you might at any one time have as many as a couple hundred people, but during the course of the day, you might have over 500.
Right. Bob, can you speak to that?
I think that's clearly kind of a policy decision, but I would tend to think 500 at one time would make the most sense. But that's just my opinion.
Okay. Thanks.
Because I think we're talking about the exposure. We go back to the exposure. So, you know, over 500, you tend to have more exposure of risk.
Can I go back to one thing earlier about these mechanical devices? Mm-hmm. I just double-checked this with Bob. Our own insurance policy excludes those kind of things. So that means if we don't require it, if somebody else and something happens, then the town is going to be liable, not through insurance, but through our own general fund money. So
something to think about. The other point has to do with food. It seems to be saying that food that's sold would require insurance, but does that mean food that's, if it's given away, does not, or is that what it's saying, that any time food is sold, then you need insurance?
I think any time food, we open up exposure, and if groups are bringing in food or even catering food, that exposure is there. So pretty much I would think any time that there's food involved, and it's not a private type of entity, when anybody in the public is able to attend, I believe that's what they're talking about.
So I could take an extreme example, maybe not so extreme, like when the really, really free market happens, and let's say someone shows up there with a big pot of lentils, they're just like sharing with people. To share those lentils, they need to be insured.
Yes. Yeah. Or going through the health permit process. But that wouldn't always cover them, because they're pretty lenient with us in terms of, you know, whether you need a health permit or not. So, again, that is an exposure, you know, when people just bring in food and it's not being regulated, it tends to open up the risk and the exposure.
Thank you, Anita, for bringing this item to us. It's not clear to me yet. Insurance always takes the fun out of the activities, you know. And
so does the depletion in the general fund.
But we need to find a middle ground where you can keep some of the fun and some less risky stuff, and obviously cover our backs on the really risky stuff. We just did an activity in Durham where alcohol was served in the American Tobacco Place. This is the credit union for over 200 people. And we were just required to provide a $1 million liability insurance policy for a financial institution. That's all what we have. That's the maximum coverage that we have as a financial statewide institution. It looks a little bit high to me that the $2 million.
We're switching to one. I believe it's a significant change from what the policy that the board adopted last fall. The maximum requirement is $1 million, and in many cases on the low risk side, it's gone from $2 million to zero.
Yes.
The food issue was, there's a lot of exposure there. All it takes is one case of salmonella to create some real problems for the town and for whoever prepared that food.
I guess this has to be, I'm not for the coverage. We need to take more risk and expose the, you know, the taxpayers of Carrboro to necessary liability. But also, I think there are certain activities that promote Carrboro, I mean, that we want to support and promote the activities of some folks called the creative class that makes Carrboro unique and attract arts and businesses and that makes Carrboro what it is today. We don't want to take the, you know, it's like, well, you know, you can't do anything because you're going to get sued. Especially with non-profits. With business, I don't hesitate much to, you know, pretty much it's required to have this kind of insurance. But non-profits, especially certain size of non-profits, we prohibited from purchasing this kind of insurance. And if it's something that falls within our goals, I want to make sure is it clear to, and maybe it's just me, but it's not clear to me that is the policy clear that we will, there's a list of activities that we will sponsor? I mean, like I see the fishing rodeo there, and this is the one on New Hope Church Road, right?
Yes.
I mean, that is, to me, one of the most risky events. I mean, you've got water there, you've got cars, unmarked parking spaces, more than 200 cars shows up there, people walking between cars. I mean, I've done it. I do it every year.
Our insurance agent is here.
And maybe because it's under somebody else's liability.
Right, you know. And we also co-sponsored that with Orange County, who is another... municipal
government. So they contribute.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So, and so again, I guess it's a combination of, if I could go back, Alderman Herrera, to one of the items that you talked about, which talked about alcohol, I want to also mention that all events that sell or offer alcohol is not necessarily under that particular item. I talked with Mr. Hayes, and we were able to put in this process that as long as it's a licensed caterer and distributor, because, see, they're going to have their insurance, then that event won't have to have additional insurance. So we really tried to, you know, be creative in some of the ways we've addressed it, and that's why that particular item, for instance, is on both sides. If you have a licensed caterer or distributor serve the alcohol, along with the fact that we have police presence and a few other things in place, you don't have to have insurance. But if anybody's giving out the alcohol, yes, we are suggesting we need some coverage.
Right. So you would think, at least, any event where you were going to have the Moon Bounce people come, the Moon Bounce people already have some insurance.
Correct.
Or the better.
Correct.
It's not like another insurance policy has to be bought for that particular event.
Yes.
Okay. And same thing with alcohol being served at the Century Center. If it's by somebody who's already licensed and insured to do that, there's not a special insurance policy that's needed. Joel?
No, I just would say that, you know, as long as it's understood, it's really important, at least for me personally, it's really important that if you're going to serve alcohol or provide alcohol, somebody's got to have insurance at a minimum. I mean, I don't care if you're non-profit, for-profit. I mean, I think that's a requirement. I mean, I just think, you know, some people, unfortunately, don't handle alcohol well, and typically, we can reduce our exposure if we require that. I mean, at least at that level, to me, that's a minimum requirement. Because if we don't, then we are exposed to a certain amount of liability and lawsuits and litigation that we could have avoided. You know, so for me, it's what kind of risk does the activity expose the town to litigation? And so, you know, if we're going to talk about not requiring certain insurance, somebody better have some insurance if they're over at the Century Center or in any other town-owned property that alcohol is served.
100% agree. If I can might finish the point I was trying to make, when for 5 years I organized a Fiesta del Pueblo, and something we did without insurance, something we did is we made people sign a waiver of liability, so it's at your own risk. How much of this can we, what kind of activities can we sponsor and say, make people sign? I mean, if the kid, I'm willing to sign for my son, you know, he's going to bust his head open in that jumpy, bouncy, whatever. You know, in the ticket, we say, you know, you hold harmless the town of Carbaro, blah, 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 blah. I will sign it up. That is clear to the participants. Is there any...
I don't think our lawyer thinks that, that our lawyer would not be real happy.
I think in even a lot of the forms that we have and the programs that we have we do have waivers of liability forms. I think all of us laboring this particular vineyard have some question as to how effective they would be. Having them sometimes, if you know, particularly I think for minor injuries, if you know someone knows they've signed a waiver of liability, that might sort of prevent them from even thinking about filing claims against the town. So I think it's certainly something that has some merit and something that we do. It's not something that I would want to bet the bank on relying that we could enforce it. The other part of it, of course, is that sometimes liability. I mean, these insurance policies cover not. Just situations where you're dealing with participants, but other, you know, spectators or people going by, you know, whatever. It's not just participants in a particular program that's covered by it. So it does have a place, but it is not the answer. It is a partial thing that we do.
Let me suggest that while not every question is answered by anytime you're talking about tort liability, there are always more questions than answers. But it seems like, to me, like the staff has explored this topic with our insurance carrier, and that this gets done a lot of what I think the board wanted to get done. So,
and move the item
35.
Second.
There you go. That's what I'm getting at. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously.
Hopefully,
wait, I got one question. Could I have? This is before I forget this. During the summer, because I know that our representatives on Carolina North are meeting, I don't want to get the information from the paper, and they don't always accurately report stuff, so I want the perceptions of the board from our viewpoint and what our goals are. So if you could periodically provide those members of us, the entire board, just a one-page update. I'm not asking for it like a whole long thing, just a little one-page update, because that's all I'm going to read in July and August anyway.
That's not Anita's job.
No, not Anita's job.
Anita's going,
I'm sorry.
We need to build a bridge before we jump.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can arrange to get that done. We're actually, at least according to current schedule, probably only going to meet once in July during a time when this board's out of session, and then sometime again in late August. When this board will probably be back in session, but we can certainly do that.
Thank you.
I have two items. Did you want to say something? You look like
I was just
going to
move that we adjourn. So go ahead.
All right.
No, you first.
just on updates. Last night, Dan and I met with the New Horizons Task Force folks, and they went through 77 surveys out of 77 returned out of 300. We are looking to have surveys continue online until the Friday before the next meeting, which is July 7th. Right, and the next meeting is July 10th. Lydia Lavelle, Charlie Buckner, and Lauren Wenzel will be going through any other surveys that come back during that time to add to the material that's already being compiled. The group that came last night, in addition to some people who were visiting, helped compile, and they did a great job, and it was well worthwhile. So So that's item one. Well, and one more item. And, that, and as Jackie said about the summit, Jackie and I are going to be getting together to talk about it because there is great interest and we are looking to move ahead. So I just want you to realize that it's it came from this board and you've got folks excited in the community.
All
right. All right, great.
Let us all also mention there's a poetry event this weekend, right, going on at the Century Center. What's it called, the title of it?
Poetry Alive.
Poetry Alive, and it's like all day Saturday and afternoon on Sunday, and lots of different poets, and details are on the website under community events.
All right.
Happy Father's Day to the fathers on the
board. Mr. Adjourn. Thank you. It's been moved that we adjourn.
Second.
All those in favor, signify.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Thank you.